This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Why does the wealth gap matter? The wealth gap is growing in the United States. A recent report from the Pew Research Center shows that the American middle class continues to lose ground financially to the upper class. Experts say this growing inequality has an effect on health, well-being, levels of violence, and much, much more. A collaboration between the University of North Carolina Schools of Business, Public Health, and Law is exploring causes and solutions to the wealth gap. The latest installment featured experts in demographics and public health. Jim Johnson's a professor of strategy and entrepreneurship, also the director of the Urban Investment Strategy Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome back, Jim.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be here.
It is good to have you. You brought a friend. Richard Wilkinson is a professor emeritus of social epidemiology at the University of Nottingham Medical School in England, also the co-founder and a board member of the Equality Trust. Welcome, Richard. Good to have you here as well.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
I don't know if you're friends, but I know that you've your colleagues anyway.
I think we've become friends
pretty
quickly.
We are new friends. Absolutely.
Jim, actually, you're a demographics expert. Tell us what you know and kind of how that plays into our understanding of the wealth gap.
Well, first of all, our country has become far more diverse, racially and ethnically, driven in large part by immigration. About 92% of net growth in our population over the last 16 years has been driven by people of color, mainly people from Asia and Latin America that are transforming the complexion of our society.
So we look different. Than we have. But also there have been economic forces, changes in our economy over the last several decades that have really accelerated this wealth gap. Tell us about those.
Absolutely right. So our economy has undergone a profound structural change beginning in the 1980s by the decline of high wage, highly unionized manufacturing employment, something we call deindustrialization. We lost about 7.2 million manufacturing jobs between 1979 and 2015. A lot of those jobs went offshore. Some were replaced by automation. That impacted a large number of people who were employed in those industries. Those industries typically were high-wage jobs that enable people to form and maintain stable families, to buy homes, to send their kids to school. And when those jobs disappeared from the economy, it left behind a group of people whose skills did not match the new economy, which focused primarily on information-oriented jobs, jobs that required the ability to do head work as opposed to hand work.
And Richard Wilkinson, you point out that this was not, I mean, this may sound like, oh, well, there's technological change, there are changes in economic relations, changes in the global economy. Those things happen well outside of our power to do anything about them. But you also point that even a decade earlier, well, not a decade earlier, but beginning in the 1980s, something else happened that was significant in terms of the relationship between the productivity and the way the economy was going.
Yes, this pattern of widening differences is very widespread. Most developed countries have gone through a period of rising inequality from somewhere around 1980. And before that, they all have the same pattern too, that from sometime in the 1930s right through until the late 1970s, inequalities decline. So there's this long-term decline in inequality in one country after another, and then the modern rise of inequality from 1980 onwards. And it seems to me it's driven by politics. I think that the processes Jim is talking about are, if you like, the mechanisms, but there will be some countries, and I think examples might be France and the Netherlands, which have protected themselves from these economic forces. I think it is possible to do that, and so some countries have remained much more equal than others.
Well, the measure of this, I think, is pretty clear, and it becomes pretty obvious what's at play here. Again, how the politics work might be another question, but up until that time, that period from the 30s through the 70s, there was great economic progress being made, great changes in productivity, improvements in productivity. But wages were locked at the hip, and so wages and productivity were going hand in hand, rising and falling at the same time. They decouple in the 1980s, and that is the beginning of...
Yes, but I do think that's because of political change. I think what we're seeing, this overall pattern, is the rise and fall of the whole labor movement. and I suspect also the fear of communism, which in some ways was good for capitalism. You know, it made it more humane. And when that threat goes, and when any ideas that there is another way of that societies can work, when labor starts to lose its power, unions are weakened partly by legislation and so on, and you get the sort of free market fundamentalism ideas, neoliberalism from 1980 onwards with President Reagan here and Margaret Thatcher in Britain. It's then with those ideas spreading and coupled with privatization, reduction of top tax rates and so on, that you get the inequality rising.
And it's clear. You just take a look at any graph. The economic progress continues, and all of a sudden wages go flat. They had been going hand in hand. But Jim, what is this? So what? So what the neoliberals will tell you is no, that's great because look at that top line. Productivity is improving. That's good for all of us. Yeah. All boats rise.
I think there's another piece to it, Frank, that we ought to put on the table, and that is what happened to white collar workers. Paralleling the offshore movement of blue-collar jobs in the 90s, the same thing happened on the white-collar side of the economy where, jobs that require high levels of education and skills and the like, they too began to move offshore, beginning initially with IT jobs in the late 80s, early 90s, and then progressing in the 2000s to business process outsourcing, anything that can be done in the back office of a firm. But most importantly, and this tendency to move white-collar jobs offshore moved all the way to the top of the value chain in corporate America to something called R&D, research and development, something we've always had a monopoly on in this country. Those things, those jobs also moved offshore. So the last three recessions have been white-collar recessions for the most part. It's no longer just the blue-collar Joe or Jane who has been disadvantaged and income-wise and even employment-wise in the economy. These have been almost equal opportunity kinds of recessions and changes that have had profound impact throughout our economy, and men have suffered the most in all of that. I talked yesterday about the end of men thesis that if you look at something like higher education, the sex ratio has been 60% female, 40% male for a decade. There are far more men unemployed today, not working in the labor market than there were in 1969. I mean, it's...
Well, does this mean, you said equal opportunity. In other words, that the white-collar recessions and layoffs that left behind now educated white-collar workers. Mm-hmm. But in terms of resilience, it is not equal opportunity because people who had less to begin with, they're still being left out in these later recessions, right?
That's true. Absolutely. They're being left out, but they're an additional group of people who are left out or who are struggling that if you looked at, we're told that if you go to school, get good grades, stay out of trouble with the law, graduate, life will be good. But at the end of the recession, if you looked at bachelor's degree holders who were 25 years old or younger, 55% of them were either unemployed or underemployed.
So Richard Wilkinson, this has a way of feeding back into these political issues that you talk about and may explain some of the politics, certainly in the United States, the kind of resentments that can be engendered when, as Jim says, I played by the rules. I did everything right. And by the way, I was told I had a privilege. Where'd that go?
Yes, I think it's very clear that that's happened. And we're beginning to see death rates rising, particularly amongst older, poor, white people in the United States. We're also seeing the beginnings of that in Britain. And when you look at the causes of death that are responsible for the rising death rates, it's a really important change in trend because for over 100 years, death rates have declined and suddenly it stopped. Things are getting worse. And the causes are alcohol, suicides, drugs, also car accidents. Things mainly associated with, I think, a sense of desperation. You feel that at the bottom of it is a psychological force to do with people's disappointment, desperation, unrealized hopes, whatever it is. But I'd like to go back to what Jim was talking about earlier in terms of the lack of the end of men, I think you called it, Jim. And part of that is men doing less well educationally than women. But I think, again, that's partly inequality. Inequality affects gender roles. The death rates that are most affected by inequality are male death rates and things to do with risk-taking. I think that the long-term trend we've seen of girls doing better at higher and higher levels of education, and initially it was that they learnt to read better earlier, and now it's in the best universities, and even in traditional male subjects, women are doing better. And I do think that that is part of what inequality pushes men back into a traditional male role, in a way of being less, more macho, less social beings.
I actually think in the U.S. it starts much earlier when you look at what happens to black and brown boys in public education. I think you see the die is cast by the third grade. That if you look at those third grade reading scores and the like, and you see the challenges that young minority males in particular, 3 million kids suspended from school annually, and 250,000 of them referred to the police for misdemeanor charges as early as the first grade. The die is cast really early.
Yes.
And if we want to solve this problem, we need to intervene earlier and have sustained engagement to ensure that those kids come out of the pipeline ready and armed with the tools and skills to compete in the hyper-competitive global economy of the 21st century.
It's interesting. I know in Britain, there's the same enormous disadvantage and discrimination amongst ethnic minorities, but the group who do worst educationally are poor white boys. They do worst of all in the studies. And
well, the disparity that we're seeing in this country may not be so much in education, but as you say, that the growth in the death rate of white males in this country. So it does suggest that there's something happening across this across all ethnic lines, but on the other side of the wealth gap. So wealth itself is playing an important part. For those people who have been historically disadvantaged, the challenges are even greater for the reasons, Jim, both implicit and explicit bias.
Yeah.
What are the other public policy? I mean, we were talking a little bit about health, but there are other public policy implications here. The prison rates, all sorts of costs that we bear because we're not addressing the wealth gap, Jim.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that we need to focus on is where the opportunities are to solve these problems. And I think at the same time that we're talking about all of these problems, we are an aging nation, and there are huge, huge opportunities to facilitate this transition to an aging nation. There are huge opportunities to create jobs and to create business opportunities that will contribute to solving this wealth gap in our society today. I also think that there are strategic policy levers that we can pull that focus on what I call civil servants in American society, fire personnel, police officers and the like, who don't make a lot of money, or public school teachers who are homeless these days. That's unconscionable in American society today. We can be purposeful and intentional in creating opportunities and extending wealth for those people so that they contribute to a narrowing of the wealth gap. So I say thinking strategically about where there are opportunities to solve these problems and thinking entrepreneurial and creatively about how to do that is one of the ways to go.
Entrepreneurship may be one, but Richard Wilkinson, you also talk about leverage that labor has lost, and you think that's one, if we're going to be intentional about shrinking this gap, finding ways through public policy to strengthen labor is another important step.
Yes, I think that we have to deal with the loss of power of labor, the decline of the unions, and so on. by moving towards forms of economic democracy, by which I mean employee representation on company boards, incentives to have more employee-owned companies. About half the member countries of the European Union have some legislation for employee representation on company boards. Often it's just token, but in some countries like Germany it's quite strong. And so a company with, say, 2,000 employees, half the people on the remuneration committee deciding wages have to be employee representatives. And, of course, that tends to reduce the pay gaps. But I think people don't realize how damaging inequality is. And it's not just that death rates are affected, but violence is closely related. There are dozens of studies that show violence, as measured by homicide rates, are higher in more unequal countries. Measures of child well-being always worse in more unequal countries. How they do in maths and literacy tests, where you can make international comparisons, the more unequal countries do worse. Even things like obesity and drug abuse, mental health, you see the same pattern. And so a more unequal country like the United States or Britain, two of the most unequal of the rich developed countries, they do worst in all these outcomes. The US has amongst the lowest life expectancy in the developed world. It has the highest obesity rates. It has the highest homicide rates. All these measures get worse. But the surprise is they don't just get worse amongst the poor. The biggest effects of inequality on the poor, but even reasonably well-off people with good jobs and education, if they lived in a more equal country, they'd probably live a bit longer. Their kids would be less likely to get seriously involved in drugs. They'd be less likely to be victims of violence. In that sense, you know, if we live in more equal society, we all do better.
Jim, what about the emerging gig economy? That talks to entrepreneurship, owning our own work. It seems maybe at first glance, perhaps, more egalitarian and democratic. Is it working that way?
I don't think it's necessarily working, but I do think that there are larger global forces that are driving us to a gig economy. When we talk about workers' rights and the like, you know, these are global companies. The competition for talent today is global. It's not with your neighbor and the like. And so I think that there's some challenges. The way our economy is restructuring now and the emergence of this gig economy is about corporations striving to be lean and mean and understanding that the world of work is changing dramatically yet again. And, you know, the future of work is not about where you go, is what you do. It's not about what you know, it's what you can find. And so there's dramatic changes. And I think personally that most of us are probably going to be free agents in the marketplace moving forward.
Free agent always sounds good. But if you're working for a corporation, again, you have very little leverage. In fact, even less now because you're a free agent competing against the whole world. So how much leverage do you have as your free agent? How much?
You have the power of your creativity and your thought. And that's what we're going to have to rely on moving forward.
Great stuff. Richard, I've got about a 30-second response to that, if you had something to say.
Well, I think that the gig economy is partly what people have been forced into by the loss of good jobs and the loosening legislation and so on that has allowed employers to kick labor around. I think it's extremely damaging. And when you add to it the likely loss of jobs through automation in the foreseeable future, you know, we're all going to be trying to make do on almost no secure work at all. And how our societies survive that depends on the politics, I think.
Richard Wilkinson is a professor emeritus of social epidemiology at the University of Nottingham Medical School in England, also the co-founder of the and board member of Equality Trust. Jim Johnson is a professor of strategy and entrepreneurship and the director of the Urban Investment Strategy Center at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Coming up on our program, a new mystery novel takes a dark spin on Hillsborough. Stay tuned.